Our West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama is in London for talks with British Prime Minister David Cameron. The American leader arrived in the British capital after attending the Gulf Cooperation Council summit in Saudi Arabia. Talks with Mr. Cameron will focus on countering terrorism, the refugee crisis in Europe, and the global economy. Some controversy erupted over the visit when, as expected, Mr. Obama weighed in on Britain's European Union membership debate. In an opinion piece in the Telegraph newspaper, the president argued against a British exit from the bloc. The three Republican U.S. presidential candidates tried to woo party officials Thursday at an Oceanside resort in Florida. They hope to shape the rules that will govern the July convention that chooses the party's candidate. Frontrunner Donald Trump says he expects to have a majority of convention delegates by the time the nominating contests end in early June, but numerous U.S. political analysts say a contested convention fight over the nomination is a distinct possibility. At least two people were killed Thursday in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, when a new bike path collapsed. City officials said a third person was thought to be missing after a giant wave knocked the elevated path into the sea. The accident on the Tim Maia bike path was the latest in a series of problems besetting preparations for the August Olympic Games in Brazil. A rights group says Egyptian security forces tortured a group of 20 people, eight of them children. Human Rights Watch said Wednesday the torture happened in February after the subjects were arrested in the city of Alexandria. This is VOA News. Pop singer Prince has died at the age of 57. Bonnie Fuller is the editor-in-chief of HollywoodLife.com.
Last week, Prince's plane made an emergency landing in Illinois. The plane was met by an ambulance. He was rushed to the hospital. The cause of his illness was identified as flu, a bad case of the flu. Prince went so far as to say that he was okay by performing a concert this past weekend, Saturday night, at his own home, the Paisley compound in Minnesota. And at that concert, he made the statement, "Don't say any prayers for me just yet."
Prince has sold more than 100 million albums worldwide. Prince died at the age of 57. The Volkswagen company and the U.S. Department of Justice have reached a preliminary agreement to resolve claims against the German automaker. Volkswagen rigged nearly 600,000 cars so they would seem to comply with American clean air laws. Senior U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer said a final settlement is expected to include an offer for Volkswagen to buy back the cars or fix them. Compensation to the owners of the vehicles will also be a part of the package. Lawyer Christy Thompson says settlement may take some time.
It could be several months before consumers can actually get some sort of resolution. But this type of settlement, a universal settlement like this that would resolve the government's complaints, the consumer complaints, I think at least at this point it looks like most of the consumer actions would be folded into this. It makes sense in a circumstance like this.
Christy Thompson is an advertising and product safety attorney. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes says the U.S. is concerned about reports that Russia is moving more military equipment and personnel back into Syria. He said it would be best to focus on bolstering the diplomatic process. Australia says it is building up its capacity to thwart cybercrime. Phil Mercer reports.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says defences need to be boosted against foreign hackers because of what he called the unprecedented scale and reach of malicious cyber activity. To help in this effort, the Prime Minister is seeking closer collaboration between the government and businesses and appointing a special ambassador to coordinate efforts with foreign governments. Australia has also admitted that it has the capacity to respond to threats by launching cyber attacks of its own. Phil Mercer, Sydney.
The Associated Press reports officials have raised the death toll from an explosion at a chemical plant in southeastern Mexico to 24. More than 100 people were hurt in the blast Wednesday in Veracruz State. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed says the war against Al-Shabaab is succeeding.
AMISOM and Somali National Army are succeeding, and Somalia become a model for those countries that are fighting this type of war.
South Sudan leaders are urged to recognize the role women played in the country's two-year civil war. Nigerians welcome their senator's decision to suspend efforts to amend the country's Code of Conduct Bureau. And Swaziland Trade Union opposes the purchase of a new presidential jet for King Mswati III.
We have been told that it is more cheaper to buy it than to lease it. And when we look at the number of ships and the dedication of those ships, we ask ourselves, what exactly is the benefit then to the Swazi nation?
Vincent Nkongwani is the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. Drones could speed HIV testing, for example, in places like Malawi. And 130 world leaders will sign a climate change agreement today, Friday, in New York. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed has praised the United States for standing by his country in good and bad times and for being a major supporter to Somalia's nation-building program. The Somali military and the African Union force, known as AMISOM, have been fighting Al-Shabaab for nearly a decade. President Mohamed says the war against Al-Shabaab is succeeding.
You know, what's going on in Somalia is a bigger war. It's a worldwide, global war. But in such type of war, one can lose a battlefield. What you're talking about are battlefields, but the overall war. AMISOM and Somali National Army are succeeding, and Somalia become a model for those countries that are fighting this type of war.
Tuesday, in your briefing to the UN Security Council, you discussed about the financial sustainability for the army. Why was your government unable to pay its army?
It is a matter of resource limitation that we have. Somali government is operating a very limited budget. This budget, the security sector budget, does not allow us to regularly pay our forces and to purchase the lethal equipment that they want to use, whereby no country is giving Somalia lethal equipment and firepower to fight against the terrorists. So when you heard about salaries were not paid, that does not mean that the Somali government is using the money in other ways, but it's using it in another means of capacitating the security forces to fight the war that we are in. And now the Somali government is clearing those arrears of the past. As we're talking right now, there is a payment that's going on in the Somali security forces, whereby the government of Somalia is paying a 4 month salary one time throughout our security forces. So sometimes delays can come, but the payment will continue regularly.
How would you describe Somalia and United States relationship?
Well, United States is a friend of Somalia, and it has been there for the difficult times and the good times. It's the major donor and supporter of Somali state building program. With the help of United States, today we have a security forces that are operating throughout Somalia. With the help of United States, we're rebuilding the service delivery in many parts of Somalia. And with the help of United States, we are reconstructing our political institutions in Somalia. So in all aspects, the relationship between Somalia and United States is at its highest level right now. But we came here to further expand that relationship.
Of course, and now the election will be in several months. You talk about that this model is a lot better than the previous one. How is it better than the previous one?
September election is a pragmatic, temporary arrangement for 2016. One reason that it's much better than the one of 2012 is more Somali citizens will be participating in the election of the next parliament compared to the one that happened in today. That's what makes it better than the previous one, but not as one person, one vote of the universal suffrage.
That was Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed speaking in an exclusive interview with Abdi Yabaro of the U.S. Somali Service. Swaziland's pro-democracy and civil society organizations have asked the government to scrap plans to buy a new presidential jet for King Mswati III, estimated to cost $13.2 million. The banned opposition and pro-democracy group, the People's United Democratic Movement, known as PUDEMO, described the move to buy the jet as insensitive and corrupt. Vincent Nkungwani, General Secretary of the newly registered Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, tells reporter Peter Clotty that Swazis are unhappy with the government's plan to purchase the new jet.
Chukwuka is very concerned about that. We have just read in the print media that the Minister of Labour has said that it can't be able to do effective inspections because it lacks the transport to do that. And we are saying, imagine that against the purchase of the jet. We do not see it. What good use the purchase of the jet is going to do the workers of Swaziland. Further, we do not have a cost-benefit analysis as to what is the benefit of buying the jet. We have been told that it is more cheaper to buy it than to lease it. Our question is that not when you compete against the many trips? And when we look at the number of trips and the delegation of those trips, we ask ourselves, what exactly is the benefit then to the Swazi nation?
Some people are saying that the king needs the presidential jet and to be safe, and that it is a priority to ensure that the king is protected and that security-wise, he needs a new presidential jet as part of his duties to conduct international relations, and that accusations or allegations being made against the king are just a figment of your imagination, which does not necessarily bode well for the image of the country. What do you say to that?
We say that we cannot surprise. People would say that, so they are seen as if they are the ones who love the king more. For us, that is not the issue. The issue is, would it not be possible? For instance, if one look at the frequency of the trips vis-a-vis the benefit therefrom, these are things which are not being openly discussed, nor can those people who support the purchase of the jet justify that. So the issue of the safe transport is not a point of debate, but the purchase of the jet.
Some people have said that they have petitioned the government to reconsider buying the jet. As to Kosoa, what have you been doing about this?
We have not engaged on the issue of the petitions because it is very, very difficult to be able to engage even in the protest marches on such a matter. Because it is not very easy to engage in protest marches in Swaziland. What makes it easier for Labour is when you align yourself with largely strictly Labour matters. And this would not necessarily be seen as such. So this would need a great deal of civil society organizations. And that is what we are trying to work on as regards the coordination for such protests by civil society, including Labour. Until we get that correct, we won't be able to amass the number of people to show the government the extent of the opposition to the purchase of the jet.
Vincent Nkongwani is the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty. The Nigerian Senate this week suspended further debate on a bill to amend the country's Code of Conduct Bureau and the Code of Conduct Tribunal. The amendment effort had been described by the Nigerian Labour Congress as dangerous to the fight against corruption. The effort to amend the law comes at a time that there are calls for embattled Senate President Bukola Saraki to resign. Saraki is facing trial before the Code of Conduct Tribunal for allegedly declaring false assets, among other charges. Paul Okolo in Abuja, Nigeria, says the Senate bowed to public pressure not to amend the Code of Conduct Bureau and the Code of Conduct Tribunal.
Well, this is in respect to the wishes of Nigerians in general, that there is no need for this act to be amended as planned by the Senate of the Federal Republic. The feeling in the country is that the decision to amend this act was ill-timed, especially coming at a time when the Senate president is being tried by the Code of Conduct Tribunal. So people have expressed their outrage at the decision of the Senate to even contemplate amending this law at this time.
Do we know the nature of the amendment that the Senate was supposed to make? I mean, had this amendment gone ahead, what would it have done to the current code of conduct? Would it have weakened or would it have made the current code of conduct stronger?
Legal experts have said that the intention of the amendment was to weaken the code of conduct tribunal and make the war against corruption to be of no effect, because the section they wanted to amend in the Code of Conduct Act is the one that deals with the criminalization, if you like, of the offense committed by whoever is brought before the Code of Conduct Bureau. The intention of the sponsor of the Code of Conduct Tribunal was to see that this matter is left solely as an administrative trial and that it will not have any criminal functions whatsoever. In effect, the Code of Conduct Act would not be able to bite. It can only bark.
Paul, you said some Nigerians believe that the Senate was contemplating making this amendment or weakening the Code of Conduct because the Senate president, who is facing corruption charges, do we know why the Senate president is being investigated or has he been charged?
The Senate president, Senator Bukola Saraki, is being tried by the Code of Conduct Tribunal because he was accused of falsely declared assets while he was governor of North Central Kwara State before he became a senator some 4 or 5 years ago. He made some declarations of assets which were said to be false. And based on this and similar charges that he's currently appearing before the Code of Conduct Tribunal.
That was journalist Paul Okolo speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 22nd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. A South Sudanese gender activist says the country's leaders must recognize the important role women played during the country's 2-year civil war. Census Kabang Lo Leong says women participation in government is important for the development of South Sudan.
Societies believe they need to live within a male leadership role model, and as such, they have grown through that, whether it's in their communities or in their villages. They easily move on to emulate that in the government because it is a system that they are used to. When you try and bring something different, it takes time. It's not easy. It takes time to start making sure more women exist in parliament, more women are put as ministers. It takes time to start changing that model. It requires to change the type of thought and ideas that most of these men have in the system. We believe that it's important to have capable women, not just any woman.
Can you define what a capable woman is?
Basically, what I am saying is what we need is to have qualified individuals. They also have the experience within that, and they are ready to take on leadership roles. I think that's what's important. In taking over leadership roles, you might find in certain areas a woman is more stronger than a man.
But you're talking about qualified women in a society where education is given to the boys. The priority is boys. And they say the woman belongs at home, in the kitchen, and would be married off.
I would first say it comes from priorities of families. I have been grateful to come from one where girls' education was put as a priority, and as such, they made sure we were in school, because men are able to fend for themselves from all different ways. They don't necessarily need the specific school education to do that. But for a woman, that becomes a tool that keeps her away from certain activities. It becomes a tool that helps her lead in society. It becomes a tool that helps her become the change she can be, a better change maker in society.
You are operating in a community where they don't expect women to be leaders. What is your experience like? Do people close doors on your face?
I have been privileged to meet those who understand that women bring a difference, educated women bring a difference into society, and they want to see that and they support it. You find that those who find difficulties accepting women in such positions where they are outspoken or they are educated, able to articulate their issues. Most of the time, these are people who maybe grew up amongst having only men in their family do certain things. And so to them, it's different to see that. And sometimes people don't know how to accept what is different or how to deal with what is different.
That was Census Kabang Lo Leong, a member of the Ebony Center's Policy Development Forum. She was speaking with John Tanza, who is on assignment in Juba, South Sudan. There could be a new potentially life-saving use for drones in Malawi, where an estimated 1 million people are living with HIV. Drones may soon be carrying blood samples to faraway laboratories for testing. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Drones are used for many purposes: military surveillance, hobbies, and now medicine, to ferry blood samples to a laboratory for HIV testing. An estimated 40,000 children were born to HIV-positive mothers in 2014, and a quick diagnosis can make a huge difference in treatment. But in rural Malawi, blood samples are now transported by motorized bikes over rough terrain to one of the country's 8 testing labs. It can take 6 to 8 weeks for an infant's blood to be tested for HIV, much too long for a diagnosis and life-saving treatment.
The results, once they're available, then need to be brought back to the health facility and communicated to the mother. And while many efforts have been made to shorten each leg of that continuum, we need to do better. Mothers are still waiting up to 2 months for those test results, and that can be a very long period in an HIV-positive infant's life.
Agnes is an HIV-positive mother whose baby may have contracted the AIDS virus from birth or breastfeeding.
It's a very painful experience for me because I don't know whether my child got the disease from me or if he's okay.
The United Nations Children's Fund has partnered with the U.S. drone maker Matternet to develop the program of unmanned drones. Drones are now test flying simulated blood samples from a remote village to a lab 10 kilometers away. And if the program works, UNICEF is hoping to have drones carry out up to 250 tests at a time to labs across Malawi. Jessica Berman, VOA News.
World leaders will take historic action at the United Nations today, Friday, to try to slow the effects of climate change and fix some of the damage when they signed the climate deal reached in Paris last December. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
Super Cyclone Winston slammed into the Pacific Island nation of Fiji in February, killing 44 people and causing $1 billion in damage.
The frequency and intensity of extreme weather events such as Winston's is increasing. And we all have to be fearful about what this means, not only for ourselves, but for future generations.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has long urged leaders to take action on climate change.
That is the only way which we can save this one only planet Earth.
Last December in Paris, leaders hammered out the details of an agreement to limit global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius. It also lays out a roadmap for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and mitigating the effects of a warming planet. That includes moving towards renewable energies such as wind and solar power. In New York on Friday, leaders from more than 130 countries will take the first step towards implementing their commitments by signing the agreement. Then governments must ratify it.
For the Paris Agreement to enter into force, it must cross two critical thresholds. First, at least 55 parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on climate change must ratify the agreement. And those 55 parties or more must represent at least 55% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
Key to implementation are China and the United States, which together account for about 40% of the world's emissions. Both have urged early entry into force of the deal. The target date is 2020, but if countries ratify quickly, it could happen this year or early 2017. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
It's 25 minutes past the hour, time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Auma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Mozambique tackle Morocco, then Egypt play Zambia in semi-final action at the Africa Futsal Cup of Nations here in Johannesburg, South Africa today, Friday. Meanwhile, Namibia hosts Swaziland in Windhoek in the return leg of the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifiers today, Friday. Guinea play Liberia. Somalia engage Ethiopia as Botswana welcome Zimbabwe. Tomorrow, Saturday, Mauritius hosts Mozambique. Uganda welcome Rwanda and Niger play Tunisia. In rugby news, Namibia plays Spain as the United States of America engage Hong Kong in Group A fixtures at the World Rugby Under-20 Trophy in Harare, Zimbabwe tomorrow, Saturday. Zimbabwe face Uruguay as Samoa play Fiji in Group B action. Staying in Harare, Kenya play Uganda before Tanzania challenge hosts Zimbabwe in the ICC Africa Women's T20 World Cup qualifiers tomorrow, Saturday. The winner of the five-day round-robin event will progress to the global qualifier for the 2018 ICC Women's World 2020 tournament to be staged in the West Indies. Meanwhile, Kenya's anti-doping bill will be signed into law today, Friday. Kenya's head of state, Uhuru Kenyatta, assured the Nairobi media on Thursday. This follows Kenya's Senate approving the bill on Thursday. Kenyatta had earlier this month assured Kenyans the bill will be signed into law ahead of the 2nd May deadline set by the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. In karate, the three-day Africa Karate Championships starts in Libreville, Gabon today, Friday. Finally, in volleyball, the annual Africa Women's Club Volleyball Championship gets underway in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, today, Friday. Egypt's El Ahli are defending champions at this contest that runs until the 30th of April. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, April 22nd.
This is Papa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. President Obama of the United States, with this your wonderful visit to Saudi Arabia, we hope that you will do everything possible to reconcile between these two great nations, Saudi Arabia and Iran respectively, so that at the end of the day, they will understand each other and resolve their differences for peace and stability. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United States, China, and other world powers are demanding an end to disputes that have held up the peace process between South Sudan's government and rebel forces. 10 countries, the European Union and the African Union, released an ultimatum on Thursday saying they expect rebel leader Riek Machar to return to the capital, Juba, no later than April 23rd. And that's it for this Friday, April 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a lovely weekend.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses World Immunization Week, the progress made on the vaccine front, and the remaining challenges. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3368. 3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.